You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. What it takes. The battle to define carbon neutral and GHG neutral LNG. Published by Housley Carr. There's been a slew of high-profile shipments of carbon-neutral LNG the past few months, typically involving the use of carbon credits to offset, ton-for-ton, the carbon dioxide equivalent of greenhouse gases released during the production, piping, and liquefaction of natural gas, the shipping of LNG, and often the regasification and ultimate consumption of the gas too. The problem is there is no widely agreed-to definition for carbon-neutral, nor is there a consensus on how to quantify and validate the GHG footprint of a specific LNG cargo. Now, an international group representing the world's LNG importers has established a framework for GHG-neutral LNG that it hopes will gain widespread acceptance. Elements of the proposal are sure to be controversial, however, as we discuss in today's RBN blog. Carbon neutrality has quickly become a buzz phrase, a simple way to tell the world that you're concerned about the climate and that you're taking steps to mitigate your impact on it. Most often, carbon neutrality is used in reference to corporate environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, goals to make their operations carbon neutral by 2050, or sometimes by 2040 or 2060. Patagonia the Green as can be maker of sustainable outdoor clothing and gear, plans to be carbon neutral by 2025, and Google claims that it's been carbon neutral since 2007. Generally speaking, corporate carbon neutrality means switching to renewable energy and taking other steps to minimize and then fully mitigate, mostly through carbon credits, other GHG-producing elements of a company's operations and products. Most carbon credits are generated by renewable energy projects, or wind farms and solar facilities, or nature-based efforts such as protecting existing GHG-absorbing resources, or forest preservation, or adding new ones, or tree planting. The carbon neutrality issue is a little more complicated and fraught for companies that produce, process, and transport hydrocarbons like crude oil, natural gas, and NGLs. For one thing, their operations can release significant volumes of CO2, methane, and other GHGs, referred to as Scope 1 emissions, the power plants from which they secure the electricity to run their businesses emit GHGs too, Scope 2 emissions. Most important, though, is the fact that, unlike most other industries, the vast majority of the energy industry's GHGs are Scope 3, that is, emitted when hydrocarbon end products are consumed, whether that be natural gas burned at a gas-fired power plant, gasoline or diesel combusted in a car or truck engine, or propane used to cook steaks on a backyard grill. As we said in part 2 of our recent A Matter of Trust blog series, carbon neutral has quickly worked its way into the LNG trading space, with an increasing number of international shippers assembling and sending out cargoes of LNG whose full, or some cases, partial, life cycle emissions have been offset by carbon credits. As you'd expect, cargoes of carbon-neutral LNG are designed to help hydrocarbon sellers and buyers alike meet their goals for reducing GHG emissions. The concept remains relatively new, though, and many of the participants in these deals are still in learning mode, seeking to gain experience with something they expect to see a lot more of soon. It's already becoming clear, though, that there are different points of view about at least a couple of important matters. One area of dispute is whether the nature-based projects on which many carbon credits are based will actually have as much of an emissions impact as their promoters claim, and whether it might be better for energy companies to focus more on reducing their own emissions and less on trying to mitigate them via the purchase of allegedly dubious carbon offsets. We discuss that issue in depth in Part 4 of A Matter of Trust. Another contention among some is whether shipments of LNG should be described as carbon neutral if only their Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, and not their Scope 3 emissions, are offset, or if the participants are not also taking other steps to reduce GHG emissions along the LNG value chain. We should note that while many of the carbon-neutral LNG shipments to date were designed to offset all life-cycle GHG emissions associated with their gas/LNG, everything from the wellhead to and through the end-user's burner tip, at least a few others used only enough carbon credits to offset the cargo's emissions to the LNG delivery point. In other words, no effort was made to offset the cargo's Scope 3 emissions. To give more structure, consistency and, some would argue, credibility to the emerging market for carbon-neutral LNG, the International Group of Liquefied Natural Gas Importers, its widely used French acronym is GIGNL, on November 17 launched what it called a comprehensive framework for a consistent industry approach to declaring greenhouse gas-neutral LNG cargoes. given that it was developed by more than 50 experts representing 20 GIGNL member companies, and that GIGNL's 80-plus full and associate members represent a who's who of major LNG market players, we'd venture that the group's framework already has strong support, though there's also bound to be at least some debate. So what exactly is GIGNL's framework trying to achieve, and what's in it? The primary aim is to establish a commonly accepted set of best practice principles for monitoring, reporting, reducing, offsetting, and verifying major GHG emissions, especially CO2 and methane, associated with the delivered cargo of LNG. The framework also seeks to establish emission reduction efforts by all market participants, producers, midstreamers, shippers, etc., as a prerequisite for claiming that their LNG cargoes are GHG neutral. In other words, they've got to do more than just buy carbon credits and call it a day. We should note that GIGNL's framework does not replace established methodologies and standards for GHG quantification, carbon footprint accounting, and carbon neutrality. Instead, it's intended that the framework would come to be used by those involved in LNG trading and in verifying the full or partial GHG neutrality of certain LNG cargoes, so that everyone would, to put it plainly, be singing off the same song sheet. As for what's in the framework, it's complicated, of course. The gist is that GIGNL, acknowledging that different market participants have different levels of readiness, has established a hierarchical series of pathways that companies can take. The first step that anyone using the framework would take is to develop a stage statement, an independently verified calculation of the CO2, methane, and other GHGs associated with defined stages within the gas LNG value chain, or production, processing, piping, etc., with the calculations using criteria set out by the framework. Next, an LNG cargo GHG footprint for the cargo in question would be developed using the numbers established in the stage statement. In essence, the GHG footprint would summarize either the full, cradle-to-grave, or partial, cradle-to-gate, lifecycle GHG impact of the cargo. The entities involved in the cargo could decide to do nothing more, and simply market the cargo with the gathered information on the GHG footprint, or they could take additional steps to make the cargo more desirable, and more valuable, to a climate-minded LNG buyer. For example, the participants in the cargo could simply decide to acquire and retire GHG credits, typically measured in metric tons of CO2 equivalent, or CO2e, to offset the cargo's Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, partial life cycle, or its full life cycle GHGs, Scopes 1, 2, and 3. A shipment of this type would be classified as GHG offset LNG cargo. The next step up would be for the entities involved in the cargo to demonstrate the positive actions that have been taken to reduce the volumes of CO2, methane, and other GHGs that are emitted along the gas LNG value chain. The elements of this GHG emission reduction plan may involve things like improved monitoring and reporting to identify leaks, changes to operating procedures, fuel switching, and investment in renewable energy, and major capital investments in emission avoidance or reduction technologies, including carbon capture, use, and sequestration, or CCUS. The marketer also would acquire and retire enough GHG credits to offset the cargo's partial or full lifecycle GHG emissions. Doing all that would allow the shipment to be classified as, wait for it, a GHG offset LNG cargo with reduction plan. The top step in the framework's hierarchy, a shipment classified as a GHG neutral LNG cargo, has two additional requirements that push it into what many would argue is very climate-friendly territory. First, various participants involved in the cargo would each need to make a company-wide commitment to decarbonize their operations over time. Second, they would need to acquire and retire enough GHG credits to offset the cargo's full lifecycle GHGs, not just its Scope 1 and/or Scope 2 emissions. There's a lot more detail in GIGNL's framework, the highlights of which we'll discuss in an upcoming blog. We'll also look at other, similar efforts by smaller groups, including the trio of Pavilion Energy, Qatar Energy and Chevron, and a group of Japanese LNG buyers, to develop standards to better define what carbon-neutral LNG really is. These efforts are coming just in time, really. With LNG accepted as an essential bridge fuel in many countries seeking to ratchet down their GHG emissions, it's entirely possible that within a few years many LNG cargoes will be seeking a carbon or GHG-neutral label. What it takes, written by Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, and Desmond Child, is a power ballad from the Aerosmith album Pump. The song went to number 1 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart and number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100 after its release in December 1989. Pump was Aerosmith's 10th studio album. Released in September 1989, the LP was recorded earlier that year at Rick Tinery Productions in Boston and Little Mountain Sound in Vancouver, with Bruce Fairbairn producing. 6 singles were released from the record, with 3 going to number 1 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart, and 3 making it to the top 10 on the Billboard 100. The single Janie's Got a Gun won Aerosmith its first Grammy Award. Personnel on the record were Steven Tyler on lead vocals, guitar, keyboards, and harmonica, Joe Perry on guitar, slide guitar, and backing vocals, Brad Whitford on guitar, Tom Hamilton on bass and backing vocals, and Joey Kramer on drums. Aerosmith is an American rock band formed in Boston in 1970. The group, which has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, has made 15 studio albums, 6 live albums, 12 compilation albums, 2 EPs, and 76 singles. Aerosmith has won 6 American Music Awards, 4 Billboard Awards, 4 Grammy Awards, and 10 MTV Video Music Awards. The band has sold more than 150 million records worldwide and still records and tours, with its 2022 tour set to begin in Lisbon, Portugal, on June 1st.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.